know about waterboarding? Oh, that.
I knew about the waterboarding, not specifically in any one particular case, but as a general policy that we had approved.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney discloses more than his location in an interview with Fox News. Going after the interrogators at the CIA is all political, Cheney says. Cheney's enhanced techniques for the Obama administration on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, August 31st. I'm Celeste Headlee, here all week with John Hockenberry. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Celeste. He knew all about it. He knew all about it. Waterboarding.
What does Cheney not know?
Yeah. Coming up this hour, the battle against the Taliban is heating up in Pakistan. Wildfires in California threaten thousands of homes. And those poor patriots, Tom Brady's out again.
But first, Scott Shane is with us. He covers intelligence issues for the New York Times. Scott, Cheney was on Fox News this Sunday, so does he have any regrets about the interrogation techniques that they used?
Not that he expressed in the interview yesterday, which is one of quite a few he's given since he left office as vice president. He kept the country safe for 8 years, and all these methods, waterboarding and so on, were necessary to do it.
Okay, Scott Shane with the New York Times.
Message.
Hang around. We're going to talk about more about that. But first, everything you need to know for this morning.
Well, in the headlines, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says hearts are heavy after the deaths of two L.A. County firefighters battling massive wildfires threatening 12,000 homes in Southern California. The top U.S. general in Afghanistan is expected to say the current military strategy isn't working in a report out today. According to our partners, the BBC, in the report, General Stanley McChrystal likens the U.S. military to a bull charging at a matador, weakened with each cut.
More results coming out from Afghanistan's presidential election are expected today, with about a third of the ballots counted. Incumbent President Hamid Karzai has 46% of the vote. And staying overseas, Iraqi officials have discovered remnants of the country's air force. The defense ministry found 19 fighter jets in storage in Serbia. Officials learned of the jets while searching for government assets that Saddam Hussein had stashed abroad.
Yeah, save it in Serbia. The White House is hailing Japan's historic election, saying it looks forward to working with the new leaders. The Democratic Party of Japan won in a landslide, pushing out the Liberal Democratic Party, the LDP, for just the second time since World War II. In sports, the U.S. Open tennis tournament starts serving up action today in New York. Roger Federer is vying for a sixth straight win. The weather should be clear and warm as play starts today. Markets were mixed at the close on Friday. The Dow and the S&P both start trading down this morning. The Dow opens at 95.44. The S&P is at 10.29. And the Nasdaq begins at 20.29. It was a flat close on Friday. The futures market seems to be reacting to stories in Japan, but it looks like a negative open when Wall Street gets underway at 9:30. We're following the bizarre kidnapping story in California and also talking about the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Kids saw those images, both of the California story and, of course, of the aftermath of Katrina. As a parent, how do you talk to your kids about difficult stories in the news? Do you censor or do you use candor? What would you tell them, if anything, of a child getting kidnapped for 18 years like the Antioch, California story? Tell us your story of how you deal with young people and disturbing stories in the news. 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. It's The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. And yesterday on Fox News, Dick Cheney was
What is he running for?
That's a very good question. He was very opinionated, wasn't he? Definitely taking a stand. He was talking about the decision by Attorney General Eric Holder to investigate the alleged abuse of suspected Al-Qaeda terrorists by CIA interrogators.
We had the President of the United States, President Obama, tell us a few months ago there wouldn't be any investigation like this, that there would not be any look back at CIA personnel who were carrying out the policies of the prior administration. Now they get a little heat from the left wing of the Democratic Party, and they're reversing course on that.
And we're joined this morning with Scott Shane. He covers intelligence for our partners, the New York Times. Scott, actually, the president said repeatedly the decision would be left up to the Attorney General, Eric Holder. Is that not correct?
Yes. Vice President Cheney said that he called this a political decision. But the politics for President Obama really run the other way. He wants to get health care reform done and so on, and has said repeatedly that he wants to look forward and not back. He never actually promised there wouldn't be an investigation. He did say he didn't think that people who engage in authorized activities should be prosecuted, but actually Mr. Holder has said the same thing. But the appearance is certainly that the Obama White House is not happy that there's going to be an investigation, would really rather not have something like this. But
they're trying to stay on message with health care.
Yeah, exactly.
But now, during, and we played a clip earlier in which Cheney said that he knew about waterboarding. He also said that he supported officers in the CIA who had ventured outside Justice Department rules and used unauthorized interrogation techniques. He says that that kept Americans safe. So is he revealing anything here? Is he making himself liable by saying he knew about these things and supported people who broke the rules?
Well, it wasn't news that he knew about waterboarding. Waterboarding was actually briefed to high White House officials and approved in 2002. It was a, you know, sort of officially approved method, whatever one thinks of it. But there's been a lot of talk about a relatively small number of instances, as far as we know, where interrogators did things that were not authorized specifically, such as threatening a prisoner with a power drill or a handgun or suggesting that his relatives might be sexually assaulted and that sort of thing. Somebody pressed on the carotid artery of a prisoner until he passed out several times. Those things are not listed in the Justice Department memos that justified all this stuff. And so there's been some speculation that perhaps the people who did those things could get in trouble. Mr. Cheney said that, you know, all of this was intended, you know, to keep Americans safe, to prevent a repeat of 9/11, so that he, you know, he had no problem with any of it, basically. And he did point out that no one used the power drill and no one used the handgun.
He also made the claim that all of those things, that President Obama should pay to take in a cue from the Bush administration's techniques.
We had a track record now of 8 years of defending the nation against any further mass casualty attacks from al-Qaeda. The approach of the Obama administration should be to come to those people who were involved in that policy and say, how did you do it?
So is he making the case here that all of those things worked?
Absolutely. I think, you know, he's been out there since the spring defending his record. And of course, he was sort of the lightning rod in the Bush administration for some of these policies. And, you know, his approval ratings were not very high late in the Bush years. So in some ways, you might see him as sort of protecting his own legacy.
Well, but rhetorically is one thing, Scott Shane. Can he make that case? I mean, Dick Cheney would have us believe that there were these threatening attacks against the United States. Then there was waterboarding and hand drills and all this sort of stuff. Then they gave up the information that prevented the attacks, and then we were all safe for 8 years. Does that logic flow from the information as you understand it?
Well, it's not surprisingly more complicated than that. I mean, his trump card is that there was not a repeat of 9/11. There was not another attack in the United States, and that's a. However one parses it, it's certainly a huge accomplishment compared to what a lot of us thought right after 9/11. But whether that was a result of waterboarding and so on, I mean, one point that people often miss is that the last time anyone was waterboarded was March of 2003, 6 years before Mr. Cheney left office. So if waterboarding was this crucial method that kept us safe, why didn't they keep using it for the last 6 years of the Bush presidency? And the reason is that there was a lot of dissent from the beginning about these methods, even inside the Bush administration. And the Bush administration backed away from that kind of stuff gradually over the years, long before Mr. Obama banned it.
All right. Scott Shane reports for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much, Scott.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Marvin Weinbaum, scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute and a former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan. Mr. Weinbaum, good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask you about what appears to be a disturbing resurgence of the Taliban on both the Afghan and Pakistani side. Local and state authorities in Pakistan are being challenged by a spate of weekend attacks. They say they're responding with a new offensive that they say has killed at least 30 Taliban in the Swat Valley. We were led to believe that the offensive by the Pakistani military in the Swat Valley had really rolled up the Pakistan Taliban. And, of course, the death of Batula Masood is another indication that is the case. But it does appear that there is some pushback by the Taliban in Pakistan. What do you make of the most recent reports of the bombing so far?
Well, they're trying to demonstrate very clearly that they're still in business. We didn't really see them rolled up in the sense that they caught high-ranking leaders. Rather, it seems that most of the fighters have faded into the mountains, and they're still available for attacks, especially attacks like one that took place yesterday in Mingora in the Swat Valley, where you have a single person who is able to penetrate, in this case, a recruiting center for police. And that's virtually impossible to protect against.
Is there a positive spin here in the sense that to resort to these tactics, the Taliban is basically demonstrating tacitly that they can't hold territory on their own in Pakistan?
Well, that's certainly true in the Swat Valley. But the effect of this attack among people who really, many of whom were reluctant to return to the valley after they fled during the massive government a campaign just a couple of months ago. This has really had a psychological effect in the area of the Swat Valley, and that's really what the Taliban intended to do. They also want to demonstrate payback against the army and the United States, for that matter, for the killing of Batula Masood, who is the head of the Pakistani Taliban.
Okay, Marvin Weinbaum at the Middle East Institute. You know, you say it's difficult to protect against a suicide bomber who's disguised as a recruit, but when the NATO oil tankers were set ablaze, that was along a main supply route with supposedly troops guarding it all along. Doesn't that call into question some of the security of the NATO mission there?
Well, that's been a very, very sore point here. The attack that took place was in Baluchistan, actually, quite a bit south of here. But there was last week an attack at a crossing point which much closer to the Swat Valley. Now, this is the way in which the Taliban have striking at U.S. interests, because about 80% of what we need in Afghanistan goes through either of those two crossing points. And this is a very serious concern that we have, because we are so dependent upon Pakistan for transshipment of
right.
the goods we need.
Well, Marvin Weinbaum, then, in closing, you just got back from Afghanistan. Stanley McChrystal is expected to reveal his report on the strategy in Afghanistan. The BBC is already reporting that it's critical of the strategy right now. Do you think at the end of the day, when we read the McChrystal report, that it's going to say that basically on the Afghan side of the border, the Taliban is resurgent?
Well, we're expecting here that the general is going to request additional troops. Apparently, the campaign that we saw with the Marines in the Helmand Valley has not really resulted in any kind of conclusive advance against the Taliban. I think everyone recognizes that the problem is a long-term problem, and that we are still under-resourced for what the mission expected to accomplish.
That's a great takeaway. Marvin Weinbaum, scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute, former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan. The takeaway, the surge is inconclusive, and more troops will be asked for.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
morning, everyone. Big sports weekend, as always. The U.S. Open begins this week. Tennis, the big Grand Slam event. Roger Federer looking for number six. But Ibrahim Abdelmateen is here, a Takeaway Sports contributor. And if the World Series were held today, if the playoffs began today, the Boston Red Sox wouldn't be there, right?
Oh, no, the Boston Red Sox may not be there, but the Boston Red Sox would definitely be in the playoffs.
Aren't they behind in the wild card race?
No, they're up.
They're up. They're chasing the wild card, no longer chasing the Yankees. The Yankees sort of have the AL East locked up. But if the Super Bowl was held today, right, and the Boston Patriots were in, or the New England Patriots were in the Super Bowl, who wouldn't be playing?
And he looks right, looks left, goes right. And good piece of defending that time by Justin Tryon, and Haynesworth applied some pressure. Tom Brady may have been hurt on that last pass play.
That's CBS's Jim Nantz calling the preseason game where Brady went down. Boy, just when Boston is getting over the headaches of the Red Sox, now they have Brady to worry about.
They popped him in his shoulder. Haynesworth gave him a brutal, brutal, vicious hit. And I think a lot of folks in football land are like, oh, my God, Tom Brady. But Tom Brady, do not underestimate Tom Brady. That is the last thing you should do. He's one of the toughest quarterbacks ever in the history of football, and he will probably go down as one of the best quarterbacks ever. So I think that the best thing that people could do in New England is to have the rest of the country think that Tom Brady's injured and not up 100%, because then he's going to come back and make him pay for it.
But if he does come back, he may not be the best quarterback in history this season.
Well, I think Tom Brady still has that he's in his physical prime. A lot of players, and maybe in other eras, they were younger in their physical prime. But as you get now in this era with the conditioning that happens, Tom Brady is at his physical prime. I think he's going to come back. It's definitely going to bother him. We'll see how it looks like it bothers him as the season gets on.
Are Nadal's knees going to bother him at the U.S. Open, and can he beat Roger Federer going for number six?
I think Nadal, Federer, and Roddick have to be worried about a guy named Andy Murray, first of all. And I think Nadal's knees are going to be able to handle, and he is a guy who's actually in tennis. He's 22 years old. He's at the prime of his physical prime. So I think he's definitely ready. He took off Wimbledon so he could come back and win the U.S. Open.
But Federer is still the favorite here.
Federer is by far the favorite. He has won. He's been in 20 semis and 21 straight Grand Slams. He's the most efficient tennis player in the world.
So Chula Vista, California versus Tao Yuan in Taipei. Who's the favorite in the Little League World Series? Did you have one, Ibrahim?
I was rooting for Chinese Taipei, I gotta admit.
Chula Vista, start your celebration. The boys of August. And for the first time ever, a team from California beats a team from Chinese Taipei and wins the Little League World Championship.
Chula Vista, the boys of August, they're the World Series Little League champions.
The reason why I was rooting for Chinese Taipei is because they play small ball. And the Chula Vista team, the American team, they literally have a kid who's 212 pounds and 6'1" at age 13.
Oh my God.
There's something about what we do in America where we grow these kids big, and they were playing long ball. They were hitting home runs. They hit more home runs than any other team in Little League World Series history. The Chula Vista team, I mean the Chinese Taipei team, yeah. They were playing small ball. They were getting cheap runs. They were doing very low errors. They were pitching great baseball. But what happened in this game is that it switched. The Chula Vista team played small ball. They made it count when they got on base, and they stole bases. And then the Chinese Taipei team actually, they were trying to hit the long ball, and they hit two home runs back-to-back when they got a 3-0 lead. But it just wasn't enough.
Really quickly, do you love watching the Little League? I mean, do the kids like scream and yell at the conclusion of the games? They're not boring like Major League Baseball players who are just like, well, I just try to get ahead, you know, I try to win.
About what, as a country, what we're looking for in sports, and I think it's all concentrated in the Little League World Series. The innocence, the competition, the love for the game. You don't necessarily see that with steroid-addled Major League Baseball and the money. Laden other pro sports. So I think that what we're looking for is the best of ourselves, and that's what we find in the Little League World Series.
The best of ourselves in the Little League World Series. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, thanks so much.
Good morning.
Okay, now to a more serious story coming out of California. The wildfires there are putting nearly 12,000 homes in danger. That fire outside Los Angeles killed two firefighters yesterday and destroyed at least 18 homes, probably a lot more. It's within distance of a space observatory, a historic space observatory, and what's essentially the entire center of LA's telecommunications industry. We're going to check in on what's happening with those fires right now with Justin Seastrand. He's a natural resources specialist for the U.S. Forest Service. Justin, this fire is still contained within the Angeles National Forest. Is that correct or not?
For the most part, that is correct. There are some areas where it's moved off the forest onto private lands, but a majority of the fire is lands managed by the Angeles National Forest.
And is it possible to keep it there?
That's really what we're hoping, and so far that's mostly held true over the last few days. Most of the major fire activity runs towards the north, the west, and then now we're seeing the east, and that was all on the National Forest.
So people are talking about this being a very fast-moving fire, and I saw the speed. I was pretty shocked, having grown up in Southern California and Arizona. Why, without the Santa Ana winds contributing, why is this fire moving so fast?
Several factors. The terrain, the fact that many of the fuels, the vegetation was quite old and had not burned for some time, and those two things mainly contribute to a fire spread, even without the Santa Ana winds.
So we're now at 5% contained as of late Sunday, and what are we aiming for? What's our magic number in terms of a space where we can stop evacuating people?
Well, it really depends. It probably doesn't need to be 100% contained, which would be basically a line around the entire fire. If they can start to get good line built in proximity to some communities, they will attempt to allow some people to get back in to their homes.
Okay, Justin Seastrand is with the U.S. Forest Service. He's out in California. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And in the top news stories, we should remind people two firefighters in L.A. County actually have been killed in a car accident.
They died in a car crash as they tumbled down a mountain.
So former Vice President Dick Cheney is lashing out at the Obama team over Justice Department investigations of Bush-era CIA interrogations. Eric Holder's decision at the Attorney General's office is a, quote, outrageous political act, according to Dick Cheney. Hurricane Ximena is now a Category 4 storm with Mexico's Baja California in its path. It includes popular resort areas like Cabo. Residents there are stocking up on food, and authorities are setting up shelters. Hurricane conditions on land could start in a day and a half. Iraqi officials say they've made an unusual discovery in Serbia. They found a squadron of fighter jets. Saddam Hussein apparently stashed more than a dozen fighter jets there in Serbia. Serbia says they'll work to return them quickly. Analysts long believed Iraq's fighter planes were lost during the wars. And those are some of the top stories we're watching today.
Coming up, remember Fannie and Freddie Mac? The first ones were taken over by the government. They're posting profits now. We're going to take a look at what that means.
The government
in a few
profitable?
Minutes.
Wow.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. This is Celeste Headley. John, remember, cast your mind back a year ago when this is what we were hearing from financial experts about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Rates on 30-year mortgages fell this week after federal officials took over troubled mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and that was part of the plan. Last week's bailout put Fannie and Freddie into conservatorship, which the government will run temporarily. In addition, the U.S. Treasury will buy mortgage-backed securities owned by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The goal is to get Fannie and Freddie some much-needed cash.
So, John, Fannie and Freddie were the first.
Temporary.
Of several.
Temporary.
Well, it's only been
right.
A year.
Yeah, right.
They're now posting profits. So what's going on? Are home mortgages now out of the slump? Because we're also seeing relatively record low home ownership. To hear to explain it to us, thank goodness, is Louise Story. She's the Wall Street and Finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Louise.
Morning.
So what does this mean? Freddie and Fannie are posting profits.
Well, the economy is looking better, as we've been talking about in the show, you know, unemployment and manufacturing looking better. And so part of what you're seeing is that everyone has better hopes for the economy. It's less likely people will default on their mortgages.
But this seems, just a year ago was when they took over. This seems like a remarkable turnaround in a year.
Well, you know, maybe a short-term turnaround. The long-term problems for these companies still remain. The Obama administration has not put out a plan. They're going to tell us in February what they think they should do about Freddie and Fannie. And, of course, it's very important. These companies are like the water pipelines around our country. You don't have credit to buy homes without them. And if you turn them off, if you turn the water off, no one's going to be able to buy a home unless they could pay in cash.
Well, it's funny. We talk about how the federal government will intervene in healthcare and take over the entire healthcare sector. I mean, they by basically owning Fannie and Freddie Mac, they own the entire mortgage sector, right? Whatever Freddie and Fannie do determines credit on all kinds of revolving credit accounts.
Absolutely. They back about half of the $12 trillion mortgage market, and they very much set the rates and the standards for mortgages. In fact, they're just about to come out with some new standards, Fannie is, for mortgages that are going to really tighten who can borrow starting on September 1st. So that'll be an important thing to watch, you know, whether as many people can get mortgages and whether it's a good thing that we're tightening these standards or not.
Okay, Louise Story writes for our partner, the New York Times, about Wall Street and finance. Thanks so much, Louise.
Joining us now is Bill Emmett, former editor of The Economist and author of Rivals, How the Power Struggle Between China, India, and Japan Will Shape Our Next Decade. Bill, good morning.
Good morning.
Tell us about this enormous setback for the LDP. They've ruled Japan, the Liberal Democratic Party. They've ruled Japan pretty much continuously since the 1950s. But for economic reasons and others, voters in Japan turned them out. The Democratic Party, which is not to be confused with the Liberal Democratic Party, won more than 300 seats in the parliament. And I don't believe a party has ever done that before.
That's absolutely right. It's a revolution, but it's a revolution that's about 10 or 15 years later than it should have been. Japan doesn't have term limits for its political parties, so the LDP ruled Japan for essentially 50 years. The economic crisis that began in the early 1990s should have led to them being ejected, punished for incompetence and for leading Japan down the wrong path. But they weren't punished, principally because the opposition was too weak and incoherent and not credible. So what this represents is the Japanese voter finally losing patience with the old crowd, the LDP, and just about believing that there is a credible alternative.
So tell us a little bit about Mr. Hatoyama, who will be the new prime minister. The Democratic Party has never even held a cabinet seat, let alone the prime ministership. What can we expect from this new and relatively unknown personality on the world stage?
Well, I think that, first of all, having an inexperienced new leader means that Japan is just copying America. That is the American system. Presidents are always inexperienced. This new man, Barack Obama, is learning his way through the world stage, and it'll be the same with Yukio Hatoyama. Yukio Hatoyama, though, is not a man with as clear a set of beliefs or with as good a communication style as Barack Obama, nor has he got experience in sort of leading a team. And so what we're really waiting for is for him to put some flesh on the bones of what he wants to do. I think that we can expect him basically to be a shift to the left in the same way as Barack Obama has been. He's going to be trying to rebuild the welfare state of Japan. His equivalent of President Obama's healthcare program is going to be a rebuilding of the social safety net and of his own health system. And secondly, probably a kinder, gentler tone in foreign policy compared with the LDP, which also is quite an Obama-type change. Not a change of substance from the previous foreign policy, but a change of tone.
Bill Emmett, perhaps the headline here is that this enormous shift in power in Japan takes place as China is about to overtake the Japanese economy as the number two economy in the world. Is it possible that Japan is sinking into irrelevance as the moment that China is really becoming the strategic power in all of East Asia?
Well, I think that Japan has been declining in its relevance for the past 20 years, and China has been rising in its relevance. What Japan needs to do is to revive itself, to restore its sense of credibility and relevance in the world, on the world stage. It doesn't need to be bigger than China to do that, but it does need to have some economic vigor and entrepreneurial spirit and an ability to take clear decisions and participate in global affairs. And that's what it's mostly lost in the last 10 to 15 years under the LDP. So the task for the new government is to restore that vigor, to make it possible for entrepreneurs to create the new Toyotas and Hondas for the next generation from Japan, and therefore to be taken seriously.
And the new party begins with unemployment at a record level of 5.7% or so, and a persistent recession that has gone on for perhaps a decade. Bill Emmett, former editor of The Economist and author of Rivals, How the Power Struggle Between China, India, and Japan Will Shape Our Next Decade. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And now a couple of headlines as we check in with today's top stories.
Two firefighters are dead in Southern California's wildfires. They died in a car crash on a mountain there. Deputy Fire Chief Mike Bryant says colleagues are grieving as they battle the flames.
This accident is tragic. This is a very difficult time for Los Angeles County Fire Department.
Thousands of homes are in danger there. Many have already been destroyed. And a long-awaited report from the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan is now complete and being read by NATO top brass. NATO officials say General Stanley McChrystal's review does not ask for more troops. Our partner, the BBC, reports it says current military strategy isn't working and that protecting the Afghan people from the Taliban should be the top priority there.
The report comes as major presidential election fraud allegations in Afghanistan have doubled. There are more than 600 complaints, and they must be investigated before the vote can be certified. The growing caseload means the final tally could be significantly delayed. Next door in Pakistan, the military says it has killed dozens of Taliban militants in overnight gun battles in the Swat Valley, and those are some of the top stories we're watching today.
Coming up, it's been 4 years since Katrina crippled the Gulf Coast. We're going to talk with actor Wendell Pierce. He's the star of The Wire, about how he's rebuilding the community he grew up in 10 minutes.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Well, President Barack Obama returns from vacation this week, and I think it's pretty safe to say that he's going to be talking about health care. With Ted Kennedy's passing, the Democrats have lost a vote in the Senate. So will he still be able to compromise with the Republicans, or does Obama now have to go, and the Democrats now have to go solo?
For 57 Democrats, two independents, right? That makes it 59 without Kennedy, so it's below 60.
They don't have the 60 right. votes. They'll right. drop before. That's assuming they keep the two independents on their side. With us to talk about this is Jay Newton Small. He's a Washington reporter for Time Magazine. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning.
So what's on tap for the president this week? He's waiting for the Congress to return on the 8th of September. What's he going to be doing while he waits?
Well, he comes back. He came back actually yesterday from Martha's Vineyard, and he's got a couple of days coming up here where he's got a little bit of work, but actually he's going to go back on vacation since he missed a bit, you know, given the Kennedy funeral, back up to Camp David at the end of the week, Wednesday through Sunday. So he's just got a couple of days of work coming up here now. And there's, you know, he's obviously preoccupied with health care. As you said, this is the number one issue, and they've lost a lot of ground this month that they need to make up.
So a lot of people are talking about this budget reconciliation tactic and whether or not they're going to make up for the lack of 60 votes by kind of sliding it in under the radar to a certain extent. Is he going to be able to get, if he uses the budget reconciliation tactic, is he going to get the most important parts of health care reform into the legislation?
Well, there has been talk of that, and there's pros and cons in using reconciliation. It's a budget tactic, like you said, and it only requires 51 votes, which is great for Democrats because obviously they have 57, which means that they can let some of their more vulnerable senators, Democratic senators who have for re-election, sort of vote whichever way they feel most comfortable doing. But the problems with it are, one, it only lasts for 5 years because this budget lasts 5 years. And two, it's vulnerable to what they call Byrd rule objections, which is named after Senator Byrd from West Virginia, who's the longest serving member of Congress right now. And basically, you have to prove at every point that everything in these bills, and I hear if they do it this way, there's going to have to be two bills, one that deals with the taxes and the other that deals with expanding coverage. At every point, you're going to have to deal with these objections, and you have to prove that every single thing in these bills are germane to the budget. So that could take a long time, and if it goes to a vote on these processes, then that could actually, those votes require 60 votes to overcome. So it doesn't really help you that much because, you know, if you're going to be voting, and, you know, Republicans here might can object as much as they want, if you're going to be voting, you know, every single little minute detail on the Byrd rule, you're going to be there for years trying to, you know, iron everything out, and you're going to need 60 votes to do it anyway.
So, I mean, many people are saying that Barack Obama is going to want to avoid controversy by not using this budget reconciliation, but it seems to me like it's a little late to be worried about avoiding controversy over health care.
Sure, it's been a terrible month for Democrats. Look, I mean, the month is coming to an end today, and they've got to be glad to be putting August behind them. It's been the worst month since Obama took office. But Obama has said he's going to give the bipartisan negotiators, the few Republicans, the three Republicans and three Democrats in the Senate that are still working on a bipartisan solution, until September 15th to actually work these things out. Now, these guys have blown through every deadline that they've been given since June, so I don't know if they're actually going to make it. And I actually saw Max Baucus, who's chairman of the Finance Committee and who's spearheading this effort, at Ted Kennedy's funeral on Saturday. And when I asked Baucus, you know, how's it going to go? Do you think do you think things are going well? And do you think that Teddy Kennedy's death might actually affect these talks? And he just looked to me like a man who really is in dire need of a strong drink. And
Jay Newton Small reports for the Time magazine in Washington.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. So through the eyes of Wendell Pierce, star of The Wire, the rebuilding of New Orleans 4 years after Katrina. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. He's the star of a new TV series, Tremé, which is set in New Orleans. We'll talk with him in just a few minutes. Also, we're talking about what to do as a parent when there are disturbing stories in the news, disasters, or say this kidnapping story out in Antioch, California. How do you tell your children, or what do you tell your children, if anything, about these stories? Our friend Jeremy Adam Smith, author of The Daddy Shift, emails us. I try to talk to my son about what he can do to make things better. I took my son to several anti-war marches and told him I was trying to support children and their families in Iraq, and that marching against the war was one thing we could do. How do you bring your children up to speed in a disturbing news environment? Give us the story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now let's check in on today's top news stories. The White House is hailing Japan's historic election, saying it looks forward to working with the new leaders. The Democratic Party of Japan won in a landslide, pushing out the LDP for just the second time since World War II. President Obama heads back to the office this week, just in time to hear former Vice President Dick Cheney tell Fox News that the Justice Department investigation into CIA abuses is, quote, a terrible decision.
It's clearly a political move. I mean, there's no other rationale for why they're doing this.
Cheney called it a terrible precedent to look back at decisions made by the prior administration. In the Pacific, there's a hurricane watch along the Baja California Peninsula for the Category 4 Hurricane Ximena. Forecasters say if the storm stays on its current track, it could slam the peninsula by Wednesday. And a big win in sports for some little players. California came from behind to win the Little League World Series Championship. California beat the team from Taiwan to claim the title. That's the fifth straight Little League Championship for the United States. Some of the top stories we're following today, John.
Apparently those Chula Vista players were twice the size of the poor players from Taipei.
13 years old and 212 pounds.
Ibrahim was telling us all about that. So, Wendell Pierce, good morning. From our studios at WWNO in New Orleans. Wendell, you there? Well, if you've ever seen the critically acclaimed HBO television series The Wire, you recognize the name Wendell Pierce. He plays the cigar-smoking, hard-drinking detective Bunk Moreland. Good morning, Bunk.
Good morning.
Hey, Wendell, I got a question. It's just sort of a between you and me kind of thing. It's safe to say that you can't get a script green-lighted in Hollywood who's a trombonist unless they actually are also from New Orleans, right?
I would think so.
Well, you are.
Especially, you have to be swinging, if you play the trombone.
Exactly. And the character that you play in Tremé, which is your collaboration with David Simon, the writer and creator of The Wire, Tremé is all about a neighborhood coming back from Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. First of all,
Tremé is a very historic neighborhood here in New Orleans, where basically the birthplace of the culture and jazz specifically. And instead of another show called New Orleans, we thought it would be better if it was named after Tremé. It's a metaphor for the entire recovery of what's happening here.
And who better to get to do that project than the president of the Pontchartrain Park Community Development Corporation? Pontchartrain is a neighborhood that you grew up in. First of all, how do you dually develop a fictional property, a film, an HBO series in New Orleans, and try to spearhead the actual redevelopment effort as a matter of reality?
Well, I think it's really pretty easy to do the dual role. The hard thing is actually getting the work done of the recovery, because it's been a real slog here in New Orleans because of red tape and bureaucracy and politics. But we have to realize that we are in a disaster zone, and this has never happened before. But it's pretty interesting to be in a situation where art is imitating life and life is imitating art. But people in Pontchartrain Park, it's a neighborhood I grew up in that, you know, it's a strong, resilient folk who are exercising their right of self-determination to come back. We knew that if we didn't take it upon ourselves to take hold of the reins, that we were going to be sitting in blight for many years to come.
You know, there's this thing called the Harper's Index in Harper's Magazine, and when Miami Vice was a big hit series, I remember one of the biggest lines in the Harper's Index was the budget for one episode of Miami Vice versus the actual budget of the Miami Vice Police Department down there in Miami. What's the scale of this HBO film in terms of the amount of money, resources being put to it versus the resources that you need to really rebuild the actual neighborhoods that are so important to you?
Well, I'm not privy to how much HBO is probably spending on each episode. I'm sure, you know, if it's comparable to The Wire or something, it's probably, you know, upward of a million. We have garnered the attention of the financial world here of New Orleans and the foundation world here in New Orleans. And so our effort is finally being closed out when it comes to our financing. So three or four episodes of an HBO show can get our neighborhood back up and running.
That's good. That's a good scale. That's a good rule of thumb there. You want 500 homes, affordable,
yes,
energy-efficient homes in the
Pontchartrain
Park community.
It's beyond energy efficient. We're talking the base home is geothermal and then solar packages. Option of solar package that you can go up from there. So we're talking about net zero cost of energy. We are a development that is going to have energy costs annually of maybe $800 per home. And if you have the solar package, you're not going to have any energy cost. And that's in a city where, you know, it can cost about $4,000 or $5,000 for energy in the course of a year.
Wendell, you know, the Pontchartrain neighborhood is so historically well known for the African-American community that's there. It's produced some highly accomplished and well-known people. And I was really interested to read that one of the things that motivated you to get involved in this on such a deep level was that you saw some development plans for the community and you were worried it was going to get gentrified out of its diversity. Is that right?
Well, no, actually, it was the plans were to let it go to nothing. Basically, you know, I feel here in New Orleans, especially after the disaster, there, you know, there's an element of people who do not have our best interests at heart, and
you think so, huh?
Yes,
you sure about that?
And it would be in their best interest that no one comes back, and then there's going to be this huge land grab, and our community was slated to become swamp again, and so I knew that when people decided that a 17th century flood protection plan of a swamp area surrounding, you know, downtown New Orleans was their idea of progress, I knew that they didn't have our best interests at heart. But really, it was like doing everything possible not to let people come back. You know, the only thing that's really been done on scale in New Orleans over the past 4 years is to get rid of housing. And, you know, in a city that has 60,000 homes that need to be replenished. So I knew that it was on us to take the reins, or our community, which is so convenient for a redevelopment of a gated community, because we're anchored by a golf course and multi-denominational churches and a college. And it's very easy to just put up the gates and move everyone out and regentrify that way. So
the tough thing, though,
is ourselves to change that.
The older generation has had trouble coming back to the Pontchartrain community. What's your pitch to the young people to actually make this place their home?
Well, the pitch to the young people is the fact that we have those very assets I was speaking of, multi-denominational churches, a great setting of this historic golf course developed by Joseph Bartholomew in the center of it. It's a golf course community. The fact that you have parks, green space, homes, conveniently closely located to the lakefront, which is, you know, a great recreational place. And then also to have first-time home buyer subsidies and the energy tax break of $12,500 if you have the geothermal and solar packages. So it's all of those assets to come back. Also, our community has been 97% home ownership before the storm.
So let's
second generation.
So the mission is to get back to that level of home ownership again, right?
Yeah.
All right, Wendell Pierce, he speaks with the passion of a land developer, but the sound of a baritone. Wendell Pierce, of course, actor from The Wire. You'll be able to see him in Tremé. It's shooting this fall, and we should see it on HBO sometime next year. Definitely part of the rebuilding of New Orleans. Thank you, Wendell.
You know, John,
I
talked extensively to my son about what happened in Katrina, and I'm wondering how many of our listeners talked about that kind of thing with their kids, and if so, how did you tell them about a difficult story like that? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.